Welcome to Compound Insights, a podcast by CFA Society New York. I'm your host, Rob Rowan. Malcolm Dorson is a senior portfolio manager at Global X ETFs. He manages the firm's two global emerging market strategies. Previously, he was at Ashmore Group, Citigroup Private Bank, and Deutsche Bank. He holds an MBA from the Wharton School, an MA International Studies from Lauder Institute, and a BA from the University of Pennsylvania. So thank you for being here, Malcolm.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Happy to be here.
I am also glad to say that if anyone who is listening to this is really interested and wants to hear more from Malcolm, you can. He will be speaking at our event on July 13th called Emerging Markets, The Long March, and you can sign up for it today at CFA New York's website. So let's get straight to it, Malcolm. You know, one of the things we talked about at the beginning of this process when we were going through this is I was thinking a little bit about the work I do with asset owners. You know, a lot of asset owners will say after years of risk-adjusted returns that are like they are, why invest in emerging markets now? So I would pose that first question to you. Why?
Rob, I think it's a really great question. And it sort of depends on your time frame as well. Mm-hmm. I think big picture, if you look at broad asset allocation models and what's been back-tested to show increased diversification, reduced volatility, and increased risk-adjusted returns, emerging markets has always been an important slice of that. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe not a massive slice, but 3 to 12% has generally been pretty average. In addition to diversification, providing a dollar hedge if you're a US dollar investor, you're also, you know, at the base of it, getting outsized growth at lower valuations. So it looks pretty attractive from a valuation multiple perspective. But everyone generally, especially after the past decade plus of developed market outperformance, I think they want to know, what have you done for me lately, or what are you going to do for me pretty soon?
Right.
And I think there are a lot of different ways to skin a cat when speaking about EM, but I think it kind of comes down to two main drivers of what historically has driven emerging market outperformance over developed markets. Mm-hmm. One is a divergence in growth trajectories, starting out the GDP level from developed to emerging markets.
Yep.
And that trickles down into what you see with EPS. Mm-hmm. And right now, I think EM and DM are kind of going in two different directions. Emerging markets are sort of benefiting. The biggest country within emerging markets clearly is China, with about 30% of market cap within the asset class. And while the US and Europe were reopening over the past few years and seeing a lot of stimulus-driven growth, China was locked down. So we had sort of slow growth in emerging markets. And now that's being unleashed right at the time where monetary policy in developed markets has purposely increased interest rates to slow down these economies to curb inflation. So you're seeing emerging markets growth pick up and developed market growth start to slow down. And I think that divergence in growth has a strong translation in what we can see with the direction of equity prices. Mm-hmm. And kind of a derivative of that, which is equally important, is what you're seeing in regards to FX. So generally, the dollar tends to follow. Dollar strengthens when the US economy is seeing pretty strong growth. Mm-hmm. So right now, you're seeing higher real rates in emerging markets because they've kind of raise interest rates ahead of the Fed. Mm-hmm. And you're also seeing higher growth rates in emerging markets.
Right.
So we think that sets you up for a weaker US dollar outlook versus emerging market currencies. And given that emerging markets have historically levered themselves up in US dollar debt, when the dollar weakens, emerging market balance sheets shrink, net interest expenses go down, and you start seeing positive earnings revisions. Mm-hmm. There's also an inverse relationship with the dollar and commodity prices, which should benefit EM exporters as well.
Right.
So I think for those two main drivers, the next 12 months look really attractive for the asset class.
One of the things that I was speaking with another guest on a previous podcast about was the part of the reason the dollar is where it is because it's the world's cleanest pair of dirty jeans.
Right.
So some of it is the strength of the economy. Some of it is just the alternatives.
Yeah.
If we assume that most people agree that there are diversification benefits, there are long run benefits, et cetera, mm-hmm. The next question that comes to anyone's mind about this is, what vehicle are we using to do this? Is it passive, active, value, growth, hedge funds, et cetera? What do you all think?
Yeah, it's interesting because different from other asset classes, emerging markets is a really diverse asset class. So if you look at EM by itself, it's about 27 different countries, currencies, political systems. And what's happening in Turkey doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what's happening in Chile versus Poland versus any other country.
Right.
And then if you include frontier countries, that brings you up to close to 50 countries.
Right.
So it's throwing a blanket over a lot of different moving parts. That said, when you look at the benchmarks and passive indices, which have historically been passive benchmarks and passive ETFs have historically been really efficient ways to take advantage of different asset classes. Mm-hmm. And I think emerging markets present a bit of a different story because the benchmarks within emerging markets are one, very concentrated, 80% Asia, 30 to 35% China.
Right.
And you're not really getting the diversification benefit that you look for in most passive indices. In addition to that, they generally are built upon what's been largest and most liquid historically.
Right.
And within emerging markets, a lot of those are state-owned enterprises.
Right.
Because of the strong hand of the government in a lot of these countries. So 26% of companies within emerging markets benchmarks, or the main benchmark, MSCI, are state-owned enterprises, which means you don't necessarily have a strong alignment with minority shareholders.
Right. And a lot of those are commodities businesses.
Exactly.
Also.
Exactly. Yeah,
so you have a lot of concentration.
Right. So I think that that creates some difficulty. So, and in addition to that, just having access to these markets isn't necessarily cheap. So you're not getting the benefit of a really inexpensive benchmark either.
Right.
So I think active management is the way to go. Of course, I'm talking my own book. I'm an active manager here, but I wouldn't be choosing this as a career if I didn't truly believe
yeah,
in it.
Yeah.
And so I think active managers allow us to find the risks and opportunities across all of these 27 to 50 countries, depending on how you're looking at it. It allows you to avoid pitfalls of what's happening in certain governments, where you're seeing current account deficits, fiscal deficits, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And it also allows you to be more forward-looking. Rob, you mentioned how benchmarks can be pretty commodity heavy. Well, that's been emerging markets in history. It's been manufacturing and commodities and sort of old economy type of business models. And if you really look at the future, it's kind of moving away from these asset heavy, low return business models, more towards privately managed, asset light, higher return businesses that create higher returns, which means higher income, which means more discretionary income within these economies and people spending on themselves, whether it be education, travel, services, healthcare, things of that nature, which are more new economy business models, which kind of creates a self-fulfilling cycle of growth. And that's what we want to get in front of. And those types of companies, sometimes they're listing in London, sometimes they're listing in the US for kind of alignment of interest with shareholders in terms of governance, oversights, and things of that nature. And they take a long time or don't at all get into the MSCI benchmarks for emerging markets. So with an active manager, you can take advantage of forward-looking inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, that's exceptionally interesting. If you look at the way that the sort of upper middle class Chinese consumer completely reconfigured the global tourism market.
Absolutely.
Particularly the high end of it.
Yeah.
It's like amazing. Like it's a wave. So I think that's an interesting sign, one of the many signs of that. So, well, let's talk about valuations now, because I know you've done some work on this. You know, how are you reading the valuations of these different areas?
So I think EM it's interesting to look at valuations. They're always going to look cheaper versus developed markets, but I think you have to look at it relative to EM's own history. So right now, EM's trading at about 11 times earnings, which is more than one standard deviation below its historical average, which is a little over 12 times earnings.
Okay.
So I think looking at things apples to apples versus your own historical average, EM looks relatively attractive, especially as we're starting to see a pickup in growth. So it's not just multiples alone. You have to complement that with growth and returns. And we're starting to see a compression of ROE profiles in emerging markets starting to get closer to what we see in developed markets.
Okay.
Because of that progression of what we discussed earlier, kind of moving away from asset-heavy manufacturing and commodity-led businesses. So I think evaluations look attractive because you're not only getting that discount to your own historical average, but right now on a price-to-book basis is a 42% discount to developed markets. And generally looking at history, that discount has been around 27 to 30%.
Oh, okay.
So compared to yourself, compared to where you normally traded versus developed markets, and then just from a theoretical basis as well, when you're looking at kind of
ROE minus growth over cost of equity minus growth,
that growth level is picking up, which should help you find a stronger theoretical multiple.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go down from sort of the macro level here to some regional things, because, you know, as you say, we did throw a blanket over a lot of things very quickly.
Right.
where do you think there are really exciting opportunities right now?
We can look at it from two different ways. One we mentioned kind of briefly is, I guess, from a sector perspective, we'd call it, I think, domestic growth within emerging markets. So we kind of touched upon it earlier, but moving away from the old business model, which was making something, taking advantage of cheap labor and either manufacturing something or mining for something in emerging markets and selling it to the US, selling it to Europe.
Yep.
Moving away from that because those are business models that are really not dependable.
Right.
And everything comes back in emerging markets to a government that wants to stay in power, whether it's in China, whether it's in Brazil, anywhere else. And how do you stay in power? You increase GDP, GDP per capita. So looking at GDP, it's private consumption plus private investment plus government spending plus exports minus imports.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exports minus imports kind of depends on what's happening in the US and Europe and trade rhetoric and all the fun things that come with that.
Yeah.
Government spending is unsustainable, can't last forever. A lot of economies have taken themselves off a fiscal cliff and learned their lessons.
Yep.
Private investment, that's sort of a, due to the nature of the global investment cycle, tough to pick your moment there.
Uh-huh.
So what can emerging economies do is really focus on the C in that equation is private consumption and try to really grow their middle class, kind of like the US has done since the World War II and the baby boom. Right now, I think 65-70% of GDP growth in the US comes from private consumption.
Right.
In China, that's still about 35%.
Right.
So the blueprint's there, and that's what these economies are trying to foster, these governments are trying to foster. And as we do that, if you can stand in front of that wave, that's private consumption, that's domestic demand, and that's what you want to take advantage of from a sector perspective.
Mm.
And then from a country perspective, there's so many different opportunities, but things that are sticking out at us right now are opportunities in Greece. We recently had a very interesting election there with the New Democracy, the incumbent party, won the first round by a blowout level, way above what polls were suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that suggests continuation of economic policy, which means fiscal orthodoxy. And the rating agencies have been indicating that if we see that continuation, we could see an upgrade to investment grade by the end of the year.
Yes.
So that should bring down cost of capital, increase borrowing, and really just be a very positive tailwind for Greek corporates.
So one of the other things that is on a lot of investors' minds and on a lot of agency rating minds is the EU Recover and Resilience Facility, which mm-hmm. I said right the first time. I usually don't. are they hitting the bases they need to at this point from what you can see?
They are. They've got about a little over 30 billion euros allocated to them by 2026, I believe.
Right.
And in three tranches, they've already obtained a little over 12 billion in financing. So Greece, I think, through all of their troubles over the past 10 to 14 years,
right,
have learned a lot of lessons in terms of dealing with organizations within the EU and the World Bank and the IMF. And they know how to deal with bureaucracy, and they know kind of how to align themselves with these types of institutions. So they've been first movers in obtaining the grants and loans out of this program. And you know, I think while the rest of the world is sort of tapping the brakes in terms of CapEx cycles,
right,
Greece is stepping on the gas.
Yes.
So I think that's pretty exciting for a small, often overlooked country.
Right. It is exceptionally interesting. One of the other ones I'm really interested in hearing, because I didn't know that you grew up in Sao Paulo until a few minutes ago, is Brazil.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your sort of part of your home.
For sure. So Brazil is interesting for a few different reasons, starting out with valuation. So Brazil right now is trading at 1.2 times book value, about 7 times earnings. And I think most interesting, close to a 7% dividend yield for the whole market.
Yeah.
Which I think gives you a good margin of safety
in
case you're wrong.
Right.
So I think it looks very attractive from a valuation basis. But that doesn't work alone in Brazil, because there are a lot of moving parts, whether it be monetary policy or politics or what else might be going on in other parts of the world. And what I think is the biggest compliment that makes it most attractive right now is what's happened in terms of monetary policy. So in 2021, the government allowed the central bank, or reinstituted within the constitution, that the central bank is truly autonomous.
Right.
So no intervention from the government, no matter who won the last election.
Right.
We still see some interventionist rhetoric, but no real impact in what's happening in terms of monetary policy decisions. And because of that, we've seen, I think, 15 hikes since the beginning of last year.
Right.
Interest rates moved from 2% to 13.75% right now.
Yeah.
So real first movers in terms of choking off inflation, slowing down your economy. But now you have the highest real rates in the world. Inflation's around 4.5%, 5%. So really strong real rates.
Right.
That makes people very comfortable with the currency. And it also takes people who are searching for yield globally and looking for some of that diversification, take a strong, hard look at Brazil. And as those flows come in, that only supports the currency because it's more people buying reais and it's FDI.
Right.
And through the translation effect, inflation comes down because the currency is stronger. And as inflation comes down, that's kind of where the point where we are now. The real is below 5. The central bank's taking a look and saying, maybe we have room to start cutting rates ahead of the Fed.
Right.
And as you do that, you're starting to stimulate borrowing and growth again. And I think some longer duration plays, some plays on companies have had maybe have a little bit too much debt or floating rate debt that can benefit from rates coming down. All of these stories look really attractive.
Yeah, that to me is exceptionally interesting. The speed and the consistency with which Brazil raised its interest rates was, in for what it's worth, and from my perspective, exceptionally prudent, because the Brazilian economy was not going to weather a double-digit inflationary rate for very long.
I agree.
Right? It would have been really, really difficult to maintain even the government under that level.
I totally agree. And no matter what mandates are, I think in developed markets, you kind of can read between the lines that sometimes central banks are as focused on growth as they are inflation.
Right.
In Brazil, it's inflation, inflation, inflation.
Yes.
I mean, with the history of hyperinflation and what it can do to a government and an economy, that's their primary concern.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, so, the other one that is exceptionally interesting we talked about before is Mexico.
Yes. Mexico, similar in terms of decoupling from what the U.S. has done.
Yep.
Mexico raised a lot of eyebrows through COVID in the lack of stimulus that was handed out to its population. This especially sort of surprising coming from the AMLO Morena government,
right,
which tends to focus more on kind of bringing up the lower classes, redistribution of wealth. And you would have thought that in a challenging time, Morena and AMLO would have kind of helped out their economy a little more, their population more through fiscal stimulus. And they didn't. Because one of the pillars of his election was really fiscal discipline.
Yep.
People wondered how he was going to balance that. How are you going to raise up your entire population, not entire population, but a big part of your population out of poverty into the middle class while not spending a lot of money? And he kind of took the difficult medicine during COVID. And at the same time, the central bank sort of took a similar approach by raising interest rates pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So they've curbed inflation. They're not coming off this sort of stimulus hangover that the US and Europe are.
Right.
And the economy is doing very well and doing so kind of on its own in a sustainable manner. So in terms of rhetoric, the central bank has decoupled. They've stopped raising rates ahead of the Fed. We think that they could cut before the Fed as well.
Mm-hmm.
And any signs of what we're seeing in terms of a soft landing in the US, that is a very key driver for expectations in Mexico.
I think
Mexican valuations earlier this year, we've caught up a little bit. Were discounted because people were afraid of a hard landing in the U.S.
Right,
and better the U.S. does, I think that improves our prospects for Mexico.
Yeah, or even at a what might be called a long landing.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and then last, sorry, excuse my ramble a little bit, but there's the nearshoring opportunity.
Right.
So everybody's looking for supply chain diversification out of China. The big story has been how India and Southeast Asia have benefited so much from it. But Mexico is our neighbor. We've got the new NAFTA agreement, free trade across the border, and labor is inexpensive. Manufacturing facilities are there, and there's a ton of foreign direct investment going into northern Mexico for those purposes, which should lift all ships.
Yeah. I mean, and this is the thing to me is fascinating. Some of these global arrangements got tarnished fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, did NAFTA come around when all three countries' inflation rates were relatively benign compared to some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a really interesting video cast with a professor from Harvard who was saying I could talk to you about monetary policy, et cetera, and long terms, but I could just say to you this, at bad times, it's good to have good neighbors.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So thank you, Malcolm, for being here on the podcast. We're going to leave it there. I want to make sure you have some dry powder for the event in July. And that is, once again, our July 13th CFA New York Emerging Markets Long March event, at which Malcolm will be a speaker.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Rob.
And thank you all for listening to this podcast by CFA Society New York. Until next time, I'm your host, Rob Rowan.